I'll stop there.
Thank you. Wonderful, Andrea. Thank you very much. Now we have some time for questions. So let me start with the first one, that it's to all of you, to all of our three speakers. And it's about, just a minute, while individual academics are leading voices in exposing human rights abuses in Tibet and Xinjiang, Western universities collaborate in technology transfer towards the CCP repression effort. Can this change? What role can academia and academics play in responding to these genocidal policies? Wow, that should be a question to all of you three. So if I may start, maybe Dr. Fiskes here, please.
Well, thank you so much. And thank you to Andrea also for a very interesting presentation from you. It's nice to meet you virtually. I would like to say about what academics can do that I think that information and interpretation is what we do and is what we should be doing. Try to tell people how to interpret the news and how to read beyond the news. And if we can, you know, on the one hand, demand our own universities to investigate, do we have projects run from our university that supports the genocide in Xinjiang or something like that, we should investigate. And of course, in each of our countries, we can also be activists and raise demands. But I do think the number one is our duty to inform and analyze and spread the word. Thank you.
Thank you very much. If I may ask maybe Andrea and then Kate, if she's still here, please, Andrea.
Yes, thank you. Thanks. And thanks also, Magnus, it's very nice to meet you as well. I'm sorry, I'm not even going to try to pronounce your last name, so if I can just call you Magnus, okay? Basically, I think you nailed it. Inform, analyze, and then also the obvious for us as academics, writers, people, just whatever, whether it's folks, teaching, researching, giving whatever interviews, whatever it might be, also to absolutely not self-censor, right? So, and to be very clear and upfront also with our students about what is going on. This obviously came to a head this fall with the Hong Kong National Security Law and, sort of the now heightened risks of, essentially teaching really sort of, I think, anything relating to Chinese politics and human rights. So to be candid, forthright, and not to, certainly not to self-censor, and to demand accountability from our institutions if they are doing something that may well be supporting human rights abuses in China or anywhere.
Thank you very much, Andrea. Now, if Kate is still online, maybe Kate, can you answer as well? Thank you.
Yeah, sure. And thank you for those two great presentations, Marcus and Andrea. That's really great. I learned a lot with those. So I would echo exactly what both have said, but perhaps I would say Marcus referred to an information gap. I agree completely with that. I would say not only an information gap, but also an interpretation gap. So it's even more crucial now to understand and to decrypt the ideological DNA and the language of the Communist Party in terms of understanding the situation and how it relates to Tibetans. And I would also say to academics always to speak to and to try to talk to Tibetans themselves in terms of gaining an insight. Tibetans, there's a new generation of trilingual Tibetans who have come from Tibet who have very deep understanding and insights into the systematic ways in which the Communist Party policies are transforming their culture, which need to be taken into account. I would also say that in terms of academic conferences or any conferences on the region, always to endeavour to have Tibetan speakers. I've just seen an example of this. There's a conference bringing together experts on across the Himalayas and across the world on water and on environmental issues in the Himalayas, and there's people there from many different Western countries, many different Asian countries, but not one Tibetan speaker. So I would simply suggest that.
Thank you very much, Kate. I can't see more questions, so I will ask for last time, if there are any questions, you can send them or write them directly to our chat, or you can also use our Facebook and ask via our Facebook. Give us a few more minutes, we can check if there are any more. Oh yeah, there's one more from Philip asking Kate Saunders. Kate, could you compare what is going in Tibet, Xinjiang, and southern Mongolia? And while in the beginning of the Xinjiang campaign, it was informed by Chen's experience from crackdown in Tibet, is now the Tibetan regime learning from the Xinjiang experience? So, please. Kate, question to you.
Yeah. Thank you for that. That's a key question, and many of you will have seen Adrian Zentz's recent research on the new military style training programs in Tibet, which have been developed. So there are a number of important differences and also problems with applying the Xinjiang model to what's happening in Tibet. I think that there are important similarities in both places. The PRC is using the rubric, the very opaque rubric of poverty alleviation, to further extend the reach of the state into the lives of people, Uyghurs and Tibetans, to extend surveillance and social control mechanisms in Tibet. And I think also we don't have the same evidence of mass internment in Tibet, but Adrian has documented a network of the military-style vocational training camps, which are being used for displaced rural workers. And these mass programs are similarly linked in terms of there's a major focus on indoctrination, there's a major focus on ideological training and intrusive surveillance measures. And these intrusive social control measures were first implemented in a mass scale in Tibetan areas when Chen Guangguo was based there prior to his transfer to Xinjiang. And then there's been a sort of feedback loop as these measures are employed in Xinjiang, with some elements of them being redeployed inside Tibet on an even larger scale than before. So these are top down. As Marcus referred to, Chen was a sort of creative implementer of top down policies. Of course, he's been the person most associated with them and named in terms of possible sanctions with the Magnitsky-style mechanisms that are attracting a lot more interest these days. But it's very much he was the person who implemented those from the top down. Does that answer the question?
May I have a question?
Oh, sorry, could I add one thing to that answer, which is that there is cooperation as well in terms of military training with Xinjiang troops and also Tibetan troops. They actually train together on the Tibetan plateau in high altitude specialist gyms, and I think that we're seeing the results in terms of the tougher policies and the higher levels of militarization. Sorry.
Thank you, Kate. So Professor Lolova first, and then Didi is waving, and then we have one question from audience. So please, Professor.
Yeah, I just have a brief remark regarding the presentation of Magnus. Actually, recently there was a well-known Czech professor who criticized Synopsis for criticizing China and human rights abuses in China, saying, yes, in Xinjiang, they are re-education camps, but they are no concentration camps, and we should understand that there is a difference, yeah, etc. So it fits. And I, of course, for quite some time think about the analogies between the Nazi solution of removing population, unwanted population. So I just make this remark, and if you were interested, I would very much appreciate if I could translate your article into Czech, because the comparison with Heydrich should be moving for Czech people who just don't want to understand what's going on in Xinjiang. And if you have this kind of touching example that really touches on your own national experience, it may perhaps help people thinking differently about China's achievement in the field of human rights. Thank you.
Magnus, if you want to react, please.
Oh, yes. I just thank you very much. I am very interested in hearing more. And when I finish this article, which I hope is very soon, I certainly would love to send it. And the only point I would like to add is that I find what's very striking about the Nazis is how the final solution, the concentration camps, all of that was a work in progress. They were they didn't have a complete ready plan. They were developing the methods and along the way, and Heydrich's role was to be a creative part of that and a leader of that development. But that's not widely understood. I find many people somehow believe that they had a ready-made killing machine. In the beginning, they talked about expelling people and sending them to Madagascar. Heydrich talked about sending people from Prague to Madagascar to get rid of them. And I don't think he was joking. He was not ready. He was not at the point yet where he was going to put people in a gas oven or execute them. This is contributing to, I think, a lot of misunderstanding that the Nazis actually were inventing some of this as they went along. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that. We are really looking forward to your article that should be on Synopsis in English and Czech very soon. Didi, you have one question, and then we have a question from audience. Yeah. Let's go first.
Thank you very much. This discussion about Sinicization, Germanification, Chen Guo and Heydrich just got me racing to look through something that I actually wrote in 2012 when I was in Beijing for the International Herald Tribune, where I was in the Great Hall of the People, and Hu Deping, the son of Hu Yaobang, gave a speech in a small closed circle where he described contemporary China as quote unquote fascist in public, in Chinese, in the Great Hall of the People. And this really sort of struck me, because this was going towards the direction of these comparisons with the Communist Party and Nazism that I think people have been unwilling to go into for various reasons. And Magnus, you yourself raised the reasons why, for example, not willing draw parallels that perhaps aren't quite correct or etc. But it really just struck me that this is this concept of, you know, fascism is actually discussed, of course, in China and even among very, very high level officials. So that was sort of super interesting. And I can send you that article if you're interested, but it was kind of a strange moment. Of course, that's a whole other issue there. My actual point, as well as that, was to make, to ask that if we're going to be in this sort of territory of personalities, which I think is completely fascinating. Chen Quanguo, what kind of a person is he? I heard a rumor, and I was wondering if you'd heard this too, that he was an orphan and was sort of raised in state orphanages in China. I don't know if this is correct, and I'm not impugning anyone who is an orphan who's been well treated and raised happily. I think this is wonderful, but I'm just wondering if we're going to get into psychological territory, which is brilliantly interesting, whether this is something that you've researched and looked into, his actual childhood experiences. I also did quite a lot of research into Xi Jinping himself and his childhood experiences in some of the archives in Beijing when I was still there, not long after this thingy happened in the Great Hall of the People with Fascism. This childhood development and the formation of a certain type of personality, somebody perhaps like Chen Quanguo, just a comment. And I wonder if you've thought about that and gone there at all.
Thank you very much. The short answer is no, I haven't, but I'm very interested in psychological interpretations and information, and I think it is very important to try to understand. I had not heard about him growing up in orphanages. I think there would often be this a resentment if oneself. I've only read that he grew up during the famines in the early 60s, and so he would have been suffering, and maybe those people who have been suffering, like Xi Jinping in his cave or village, they would resent others not also suffering like they do. Then there's a very interesting aspect of whether there are these Oedipal complexes. Just as George Bush the younger had to invade Iraq because his father didn't complete the job, there's been people writing about how Xi Jinping's father was in charge of Xinjiang, but he was kind of nice to them. And so now the son has to somehow finish the job. Those are very speculative thoughts, but mm-hmm. I think the psychology of these people definitely would play a role, and it's just very hard to know.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, Judy, for question, Magnus, for reaction. We have two more questions from audience, so let me read them. One is for all of you. It's one question from audience member. In relation to the first panel, are any of the panelists aware tech transfer that is being used to target Uyghurs or Tibetans? I don't know, maybe Didi would like to add something as well, if you don't know. Or so Magnus, Kate, Andrea, if you can react, any one of you, please. No.
I could. I'm sorry. Could you repeat that question?
Of course. In relation to the first panel, are any of these panelists aware of tech transfer that is being used to target Uyghurs or Tibetans?
There's a facial recognition system which was created in a company in Hamburg, I believe, and I would have to chase down the name of the company, but it was sold to China So I don't know. This kind of example is, of course, very worth following. I don't know where it went in the end. But, Maya Wang and Human Rights Watch Report did a lot of tracking of technology and how it's used. And I think that the fundamental point that we have to remember with technology transfer is that when you think of where China was in 1949, essentially pretty much everything that has pretty much all the technology in China, frankly, today, at some point was taken or brought over from the West or reinvented or redigested, etc. And of course, there has been some recent innovative development, yes, no question, but very often it's the second line development. So they will take a foundational technology from somewhere outside China and reshape it, rework it, very often do a very good job. You know, TikTok and WeChat are two very good examples of technology that's actually really great to use if it was safe. That's specifically with Tibet, Xinjiang. I guess Human Rights Watch might be a good source for that.
Thank you, Didi. Kate is waving to us, so maybe she would like to add something, and then Margaret. Kate, please.
Oh, I was actually waving with regard to the last point, but on the tech transfer, most definitely there are transfers and exchanges with particularly related to facial recognition technology, and of course Chen, numerous methods were used in Tibet in terms of, for instance, Hikvision, the facial recognition technology, which identified apparently ethnic minorities, although I'm not sure how advanced that is at the moment, but that was used on the Tibet Railway in the early stages, and there's a lot of interest and transfer of skills. Of course, in the UK Parliament, we have Hikvision cameras, and in various shops, the facial recognition technology is utilised. So there are many exchanges.
Thank you, Kate. I can just add that in Czech Lower Senate, we have some Hikvision cameras as well. They were given by some Czech business people. Magnus, please.
Oh, I remember one case. There's a geneticist at Yale University who collaborated with Chinese geneticists for the genetic profiling of ethnic minority people in China. And I don't remember the name right now, but I think it's possible to look up, and that is one example. I do believe there are more. Thank you.
Was that actually something to do with Fisher? Was that Sui Li Wei at the New York Times who did that story? She pulled something together about that. Was an American company, right, that was doing this genetic profiling?
This scientist at Yale helped devise the procedures that they took with them back. And there was also, I think, a big interview with him on NPR, the American public radio station, where this geneticist was apologetic and said he didn't understand that his help could be misused or anything like that. So it made a bit of a splash. I think several news organizations wrote about it, and NPR actually spoke to him. I could also find that link.
Right, I have it right here. It was a Massachusetts company, Yale researcher. It was Thermo Fisher.
Mm-hmm.
Kenneth Kidd and Thermo Fisher, Uyghur DNA. Thermo Fisher.
Didi, can we ask you to share this link with us on our
chat?
And also the article that you mentioned before. So we can share with all our audience. Wonderful. We have another two questions. I'm sorry. I will read them. The first one is from Frank Uris, and he's asking, it seems that there is more awareness about animal cruelty than on what's happening in Xinjiang and Tibet. As it was highlighted that China is extremely good at co-opting international organizations, shouldn't local NGOs and civil society groups pressure the policymakers on standing against genocide taking place in the 21st century? Question to all of you. So maybe Magnus, if you can start. I can see you nodding, please.
Well, I certainly agree that we should speak up and that countries and governments should speak up. There was a longer list of countries around the world, not just European countries and Australia, Japan, but several other countries like Haiti and other countries joined in recently at the United Nations to protest. And so this tide seemed to be turning a bit on that arena, which is the UN in Geneva. But certainly, we should try and push for people to speak up and protest and take action.
Thank you. Maybe Kate or Andrea, do you want to add something? No? So there is one question actually to all of you, but I think it's more for Andrea. Julia is asking, how to reply to those who argue that trying to isolate China, for example, not attending the Olympic Games, will only harden its stance, give more arguments to staunch nationalists, and maybe make it more difficult to reach any improvement in the conditions of people in Xinjiang and Tibet? So, Andrea, may I ask you for an answer, please? Or Magnus?
Oh, yeah. Certainly. Can you hear me? It's good. Okay. Right. It's an excellent question and observation. But I think that if we look back to the 2008 Olympics and then sort of magnify that, you know, a thousandfold, I think it's clear that really the Olympics ended up being a human rights disaster, both before, during, and after in 2008. And it created the conditions really for stronger authoritarian rule, for someone like Xi Jinping to come to power and implement the policies that he's implementing now. And so that I think that that we shouldn't, our participating in the Olympics will not have any, I don't see any benefit, and I only see harm, really, based on the experience in 2008. I mean, China, right, I think just very recently at the Xinjiang Work Forum, right, Xi Jinping said, these policies are great, they're correct, you know, and we're just going to keep doing what we're doing and also start to sort of implement these similar policies in Tibet, right? So I mean, the nationalism, point is also, I mean, it's well taken, but I just think that looking at the pros and cons of either participating or not participating, I think overwhelmingly in my view, the sort of the non-participation is actually, I think, in the long term, more effective than, I mean, basically, if we participate, we just become part of an enormous propaganda ploy, right? And these are Xi Jinping's Olympics. And if we're there, we are basically giving him and these policies legitimacy. So I hope that answered did that sort of answer the question? Anybody else maybe have thoughts?
Magnus, maybe if you would like to add something, or Kate? question to all of you.
I'll pass.
Sorry, Magnus. You go first.
No, I'll pass.
He's passing.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
To you. Passing to you.
I would simply back up exactly what Andrea said, particularly that given Tibet was the human rights issue of the 2008 Olympics, and one of the reasons I mentioned that so prominently in my comments was to complement what Andrea was saying about the upcoming Winter Olympics, but also to say that it also supports China's aim of its particular focus of its propaganda and telling the story on Tibet is about openness, and it's weaponizing the whole idea of access to Tibet, and at the same time as shutting down Tibetans and locking in Tibetans. It claims it's in a new era of openness, and so in that sense, participation would certainly engage with that exercise. And it's noticeable that China has pursued this message, particularly since the legislation, the Reciprocal Access to Tibet Act, which referred to exactly this weaponizing of access and shutting down of Tibet. And that was in 2018. And so the party slogan is please come in, then go out and tell the world. But as we know, the more accurate translation of that is please come in if we allow you to do so and on our conditions, and then go out and tell the world what we tell you to tell them.
Thank you. That's great. We don't have more questions. Maybe they are in chat, so we can answer them tomorrow. Or if there are any questions that will be emailed, then we can answer them tomorrow. Now I think it's a time to thank our speakers for sharing their opinions and ideas. Thank you all for meeting us online or switching on. It was a pleasure. And I'm looking forward to see you again tomorrow. We will start at 9:30 a.m. CST time, so Czech Prague time, CST. Have a nice evening or day for some of you, and thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.